and welcome to the Scottish Football Show. Darvel in Dreamland, the sixth tier side, pull off the biggest shock in Scottish Cup history. The transfer window is coming to a close. Oh, Celtic, are they getting him? And oh, Rangers, they finally signed someone. And what about agents? What did they do when the deadline day is fast approaching? In fact, what do they do in general? We find out. A warm welcome to the Scottish Football Show. I'm West Ham's video producer, Laura Brannan, and we have lots to get through again this week. No Finlay Marks this time. We're still waiting to hear if his baby has arrived yet over in Melbourne. But instead, I am joined by Sky Sports' Andrew Dixon and Sky Sports' Anthony Joseph. Wait, do you two sit next to each other in the office?
Not quite. Not next to each other. They usually keep Celtic and Rangers fans away from each other, even in London.
No, I am tucked away in the corner out the way, which is probably the best place for me.
I think people probably think we don't get on, but we do. Well, I think we
sometimes,
do anyway.
Sometimes. Yeah, no, it's a bit of a myth, that one, that if one supports one team and one supports another, then that must be that must make for a tense situation in the office. But no, we get on pretty well.
One of the best things I saw this week was Davey Martindale saying he had a wee go at his players at half time. It wasn't quite a wee go, was it, Andrew?
I mean, a wee go's kind of playing it down ever so slightly. I don't know quite who it is that's managed to get the recording, but somebody's been within earshot of the dressing room. Fair to say that it was the hairdryer treatment and every other kind of treatment thrown in as well. Not a happy guy. And it's funny as well, because David Martindale is kind of seen by quite a lot of people now as this happy-go-lucky wee guy, and he, you know, just maybe punched above his weight a little bit, and, you know, not naturally a football manager. But I wouldn't like to get on the wrong side of David Martindale at all. You know, I mean, he does come across pretty well, I think. You know, he's quite honest and likes to have a bit of a laugh with people. But I found it quite refreshing, to be honest, to hear that kind of thing from him. I'm not entirely sure he'll be massively happy that a recording of him going absolutely ballistic at his players has made it onto social media. And he's active enough on social media as well, so he will certainly have seen it on social media. Probably the last place that he wants to be seeing that kind of thing pop up. But I would imagine, while he's not happy about it, probably supporters will be delighted to hear that kind of thing, because, you know, I mean, too often nowadays, people talk about how there's not enough fight in players and management and what have you. I think it's fair to say that Davey Martindale showed plenty of that at the weekend.
Yes, it keeps the fans happy, because it really does show that kind of fight. The problem I've got with it, though, is from somebody working in the media, it's very hard to get access to places like the dressing room areas when somebody within the club or the opposition club has exploited their access all areas past year. It just kind of irks me a wee bit, because we work so hard to try and get this access and the trust from people like the managers of the football clubs. And when you see things like that going out, no wonder you don't get trusted half the time. So it's a wee bit annoying for someone like me in my position when I'm trying to work closely with clubs and get that access. But as I say, from a fan perspective, absolutely first class.
It was great to hear. I did laugh at it. I did share it. And especially when I think there's a video on one of the Twitter accounts that has it together with him saying, "Well, I had a wee go at my player. I think I had a wee go at my players," and then cut straight into his rant. But no, I mean, just even at Sky Sports, we're getting all this access into the EFL and in the dressing rooms at some games, and it's great insight. Even on the BBC, they were showing Darvel and Aberdeen, their team talks before the games. People want to see that, but there has to be trust. So I didn't think of that side until you mentioned it there, but I completely get it.
Yeah, it's a funny one, because you know, people are trying to push the boundaries at the moment and try to do new things. If that trust is broken, these experimental things like trying to do a flash interview at halftime or you know, whatever else somebody comes up with, if it is dressing room access and allowing team talks and, you know, the kind of fly in the wall style stuff that we've seen in these all or nothing documentaries and what have you, you know, if trust is broken and it's breached, it might just put people on edge a little bit more. So yeah, it's probably worth considering that while it's quite a good laugh to hear Davey Martindale going through the whole team, if he's not massively happy about it, is he going to allow that kind of thing in the future? You know, possibly not. So an interesting debate, certainly.
One of the things that we did when we were at Motherwell, actually, was when we got the players walking off the pitch, we got one boy over to just give one answer, one reaction to the game. I mean, the reason we did it was because it was raw emotion. They hadn't had a second to compose themselves. But the good thing was there was a relationship there of trust where if one of them was, I mean, there were times when they were so angry and they were swearing and their reaction was so heated that afterwards you'd maybe get a text saying, like, going to do me a favour. Can you not put that out or can you bleep that or something? And we, because we had that sort of relationship and trust, it meant they felt comfortable coming over and just giving their raw emotion straight away because they knew that we could kind of judge it editorially if it was appropriate or not to put out.
Yeah, I mean, Sky Sports, and obviously Anthony will know this, you know what I mean, if something happens in a press conference or an interview, from time to time, there will be a, you know, a request from a club, like, could you maybe not run that answer or whatever. You know, it's a bit of, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, we'll give you the access. But that's for the media organisation to decide, well, do we put it out and risk, you know, damaging the relationship because we think it's, you know, it's something that needs to be heard, or is it in the media organisation's interest to say, right, okay, you know, we'll grant that request this time. But yeah, I mean, it's an ongoing work in progress for media organisations when they are dealing with football clubs. And I think a lot of progress has been made on that front as well, you know, in terms of, and you were obviously involved with that heavily at Motherwell, where you, you know, you broke a lot of barriers in terms of what fans were allowed to see by the club. As these kind of things have come out, people have adapted to it and got used to it a little bit more. So yeah, I mean, hopefully, if there is the odd thing like this where somebody gets the you know, the voice notes out and starts recording while David Martindale's going nuts 20 yards down the corridor, hopefully these kind of things are few and far between and they don't have a lasting impact and we can see things continue to go the way they have been.
Can't be having that, mate. You better get your finger out all right and make sure that you get the results.
Well, we have just witnessed the biggest cup shock in Scottish football. Live as we recorded this as well. We should have done a watch party, guys. Sixth-tier Darvel scored early on against Aberdeen, but they emphatically held on to knock them out at the fourth round of the competition. This isn't even a debate, is it? This is the biggest upset we've had.
Yeah, hands down, the biggest shock. And the thing is, for me, honestly, genuinely, I'm not totally surprised. I actually was on reminding my friends after Aberdeen lost so heavily at Tynecastle, Darvel at 22-1 is worth a fiver. And, you know, I would imagine that as big cup shocks go, this one might have been quite well backed by people as well, because Aberdeen have really been toiling in recent weeks. And, you know, I mean, Darvel, of course, smaller teams and lower league teams are going to fancy their chances, but it's a fancy their chances as in there's a bit of bravado and we've got nothing to lose. I think Darvel will have gone into that game genuinely fancying their chances and believing that they can win. I mean, we've seen footage of their team talk from the manager, Mick Kennedy. Really inspirational, you know, stirring and pulling in the heartstrings a bit and, you know, inspiring some pride in his players. And you know, clearly it's had an effect as well. It is an enormous result for Darvel, and Darvel have... are very much keen to make out that it's their result. It's not Aberdeen's bad result, and that's how we should be talking about it. And in some respects, that is how it will be spoken about. But of course, the focus is going to be on what a catastrophic result this is for an Aberdeen team, which seems to lurch from one bad result to another at the moment.
Yeah, you're right in saying it is. It's Darvel's victory rather than Aberdeen's bad defeat. So before we do get on to dissecting, yeah, Anthony, the scenes were incredible. This is proper Romance of the Cup stuff, isn't it? To see these small stands, they managed to keep the game at home. They didn't move it to Rugby Park after all. The fans in that stadium, it's proper just dream come true stuff, isn't it? And they don't come around very often. I really want it to come around all the time. But this is one that this is a really special one, isn't it?
No, they don't come around often, and that's what makes it special, and that's what cup football provides. And I think a lot of people in Scotland and in England as well almost fell out of love with the cups. Actually, I'd say that's more in England. I'd say in Scotland, the Scottish Cup has still always had its magic, and even our League Cup is good, especially now they've moved the format of it as well. And this is what you want to see. And you don't want to see managers getting sacked. You don't want to see big people lose their jobs on it. But the positive of it is look at Darvel, and that's what Darvel tweeted straight after the game, and put a score through Aberdeen's worst ever result. This is Darvel's great ever result, and they've got a tie against it's Falkirk, isn't it? They've got home tie against
Yeah.
Falkirk. They should have no fear at all to play against Falkirk. After just putting out the team that's fifth in the Scottish Premiership. I still can't get my head around it. This is a junior club. This is not even Highland League or Lowland League level, which we've seen in the past. Like just a couple of years ago, Brora put Hearts out of the Scottish Cup when Hearts were in the Championship. This is the greatest cup shock in Scottish football history, and it's going to take the next few days to properly digest that and to see what it does for Darvel, what it does for the community. I mean, the community was out in full force. That's what you want to see. It's such a fairy tale story, and you want to keep cup football going because the way things are going with the money in football, there's less money going into the cups, a lot more money going into the leagues. And we've seen that with the switch over of sponsorships and everything like that in the cups. So you want to keep the cups thriving, and these kind of fairy tales certainly do that and help towards that.
I mean, Darvel are playing in the West of Scotland League for a reason. It's not because they've got a whole load of players that are brilliant and they're world beaters and actually they should be in the Premiership. You know, they're at the level they are because, you know, that's where they deserve to be. But they have raised their game. They've taken on a team which clearly is on the back foot at the moment. And, you know, as we've seen so many times, you know, when a bigger club goes to a venue like Darvel, it can be a real leveler, and fair play to them because they've got stuck in, they've scored early. You know, I think Aberdeen have had chances to equalise, and I think feel probably that they should have equalised. You know what a magical story it is for Darvel, and you know this is not intended to be condescending in any way. They should enjoy it as though it's a result that they're never going to pull off again, because you know against Falkirk in the next round they may well win again, they may go out, you know, whatever it is. But for this moment right now, knocking out, as Anthony says, that you know the team that's sitting fifth in the Scottish Premiership, a team that has played European football recently and just played at Hampden in a cup semi-final a couple of weeks ago, it's an enormous achievement for them, and all credit to them for it.
Yeah, as you're saying there, Aberdeen probably should have had an equaliser when Majovski's goal was deemed offside, but as we know, there was no VAR to confirm it. Didn't I say it was going to be a farce a couple of weeks back? There's a likely chance that, for example, Aberdeen could get picked for TV. They're away to Darvel, though, so they wouldn't have VAR. So here's a Premiership team on TV. But because they're not at home, they're not getting it. To me, it's just so controversial. If you're going to have VAR, have it in all games or have it in none. In more serious terms here, Jim Goodwin, look, he's been under pressure before this game. He's been struggling for a while, but this could tip him, couldn't it? Is this a final nail?
I don't know how you survive this. I really don't. I don't know how anyone can survive the worst result in their club's history, the worst result in Scottish football history, not the worst result, the biggest upset in Scottish football history. Which is a shame for Jim Goodwin, having just been knocked out of the League Cup semi-final and then had a awful result at Tynecastle. Things are not looking good. But I think there's a lot of people at Aberdeen that need to perhaps have uncomfortable conversations with each other, and I think there's a wider issue going on at Aberdeen, from that starts right at the top. I mean, when Derek McInnes left, McInnes left them in a team that was probably at the end of its cycle. There did need to be a transition period, but I feel they're not any, almost 2 years on, they're not any further ahead with that transition because they've wasted a lot of time. And this is no slight, obviously, Dave Cormack's in charge there at Aberdeen, and he's done some really good things at the club in terms of building the fan culture, and improving the fan culture there and the match day experience. But there's a lot of things that need to be scrutinised and questioned, and there's a lot of questionable things that have gone on there as well, in terms of even just the appointment of Stephen Glass. What credentials did he have to manage a club of Aberdeen's size, being at Atlanta United too? There's no coincidence that he was best friends with Dave Cormack. There's no coincidence that he was at the reserve side of the club that Aberdeen have a strategic partnership with, a partnership that seems to only benefit one club at the moment, and it's not the Scottish club. That's how I view it anyway. Then after that, Cormac talked about wanting to build an exciting team, a team that's always on the front foot and playing free-flowing, attacking football. And then appointed Jim Goodwin, who's perhaps known and has been known, I know it's at St Mirren, so it is quite different, but known for being quite pragmatic and known for a more defensive style of football. So whether that was going to work, it seemed like a completely different strategy to when he brought in Stephen Glass, and he was talking about the free-flowing football and the attacking football, that philosophy, that this the identity of the club, and it seemed to suddenly change. But he didn't change his stance on that. And Cormac was talking about doing this, but with Jim Goodwin. I'm not saying that's impossible. Of course, when you're at a bigger club and you've got more funds, you could potentially be more of an attacking manager. But it just doesn't seem to have worked out at the moment. And the last three results have been awful. And this, well, especially this. I just don't know how you can recover from this. But I also feel like a lot of people further up at the hierarchy at Aberdeen also need to be looking at their own performance as well.
The thing is as well that and I agree totally. I mean, we're seeing it in the Premier League at the moment. There's a lot of displeasure at Everton for what's going on there, and the feeling very much is that it comes from the top, and that there's a bit of sympathy for Frank Lampard, although he's lost his job. The feeling amongst a lot of Everton fans is it's not completely his fault. So there are probably shades of that at Pittodrie, but I mean, Jim Goodwin has been backed, I think it's fair to say. He's brought in a lot of players, certainly, big turnover of the squad last summer, but he has been allowed to bring people in. He has been able to shape the squad the way he has wanted it to, as far as I can see. So, there is a bit of sympathy for Jim Goodwin for me in terms of the bigger picture at Aberdeen, but he has been able to build a squad in the mould that he wants it to be in. But I mean, form prior to the World Cup was good, generally, particularly at Pittodrie, difficult place for teams to go, and at Aberdeen were getting results. Since then, I think it's one win in nine games. And he said, Goodwin, after Rangers obviously scored twice in stoppage time to win 3-2 at Pittodrie, back in December, said that that was his most painful experience in football. And since then, it's almost like his team has tried to make sure that he has more painful experiences to drown out the Rangers one. I mean, losing 5-0 at Tynecastle in midweek was awful, but you plain and simply shouldn't be losing 1-0 to or by any scoreline to any team of the level that Darvel are at, no matter how out of form you are. These are guys who are professional footballers, some of them who have played at bigger clubs than Aberdeen as well. It's just it's a terrible state of affairs for them, and a big recovery is needed from this point for Aberdeen, because they are arguably at their lowest ebb at the moment.
Elsewhere, Lauren Shanklin scored Hearts' second of the afternoon in their 3-0 win over Hibs at Easter Road. That made him the first Hearts player to score 20 goals in a season since 1991-92. 30 years! That was him matching John Robertson's record. Andrew, 8 goals in 8 games. This boy can't stop scoring, can he? Is he? He's
Yeah,
going to take us to the Euros, isn't he? Come on!
I mean, he's been in incredible form. I was quite surprised when Shanklin left to go over to Belgium, and I think it was an astute move from Hearts to get him back in. And what a campaign he's having. I mean, we're still only in January, and to get 20 goals at all is a fairly decent return. Obviously, at Hearts, it hasn't happened for 30 years. And to be doing that in January, you've got to be thinking that he's going to get closer to 30 goals this season. So, yeah, terrific campaign for him. I mean, there are a few penalties in there, but I mean, the goal that he scored at Easter Road was a terrific finish. He has been fantastic. So, excuse me, he's certainly got himself into good form. He's got a really decent chance of being part of that Scotland squad that's trying to get to the Euros once again. The problem that he maybe has is that Steve Clarke, by and large, goes with the players that are tried and tested in his team, and he doesn't change things too much. So, does he really come in ahead of Che Adams, for instance? I'm not sure he does. Lyndon Dykes, does he get in ahead of him? Even if he is in good form, for his club, these two are guys who generally have done a job for Scotland. So, but yeah, absolutely, he absolutely merits a place in the squad, and rightly so as well, because he's been terrific so far this season, and a big factor in the fact that Hearts, once again, are coming through as the kind of the best of the rest, if you like.
You're completely right on what you're saying about he probably won't get in ahead of Adams and Lyndon Dykes in the starting 11 or in, as part of the match day squad. But he should definitely be in the squad, shouldn't he? Because he offers, I mean, how can you leave him out if he's in this kind of scoring form? And goal scorers are so hard to get into clubs as for good fees, and even harder to get in at international level. Even look at England have a bit of a situation with that, because if Harry Kane's out, they've got a problem there. Whereas with Scotland, Shankland offers something different that Che Adams and Lyndon Dykes don't. Shankland is just a natural goal scorer, so to have him in your squad, you can bring him on for the last 20 minutes. He could get you a goal. He could get you a point or get you 3 points. I think it would be, if he continues this run, it would be crazy for him not to be picked in the next Scotland squads.
Yeah, it's always a position we're complaining about, not having natural goal scorers. So 8 goals in 8 games, 20 for the season. It's a no-brainer for me. Look, it wasn't such a good day at the office for Hibs in any sense, not only going out the cup, but potentially losing Rocky Bashiri as well to a leg break. We're still waiting on the confirmation on the extent of his injury. But Anthony, how much of a loss will he be if it is as bad as first feared?
Yeah, well, let's hope it's not as bad as the initial fears are showing. But yeah, this would be a blow to lose him, and especially with Hibs shipping goals to their arch rivals. That's 2-3 nils. They've lost. They're under so much pressure. They need their better players. I know that. Yeah, we've just been saying they've been shipping goals, but they need. He is one of their better players, and they need him. It would be a massive blow if they were to lose him, and if they were to lose him for long term, and that just mounts more pressure on Hibs. It mounts more pressure on Lee Johnson. I mean, he got that it involved Shanklin, didn't it? That both incidents in the game, so they both got booked for barging each other at the start of the second half. And I don't think, although I've watched it back a few times, I don't think there was too much malice in what Shankland doing. I think it was just reckless. And Bashiri has unfortunately been caught with his studs. It was it, I don't think there was any, it was there was an, any intent, even though they had a bit of aggro with each other earlier in the game. But Yeah, let's hope it's not a leg break. You don't wish that on anyone, and wish him a speedy recovery, because Hibs need him. Lee Johnson needs him.
You think I'm going to answer a stupid question like that?
Now, you two are going to be busy next week with deadline day fast approaching, but let's look at what's been hitting the headlines so far and what's still expected to happen. Anthony, you've been all over this Josip Juranovic move from Celtic to Union Berlin. How big a loss is he going to be to the club?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. I mean, we knew his situation before the window and after the World Cup. I mean, he felt at turning 28, which is going to be, if he could move to one of the top leagues, then he'd try to, and he wanted to do that. So Celtic were prepared for this. They'd already signed his replacement, and his fee is going to be covering all their transfer activity this window. So in terms of it being a big loss, I think they'll be fine without him domestically, to be honest. I think Alistair Johnson has already proven that he is capable of filling in domestically. And then they've also got Ralston as well, who has shown that he's progressed under Postecoglou. But in Europe, where it's top level, you need that, especially in the Champions League. And Juranovic showed at the World Cup that he is top level and he is at his peak of his career. So that, well, time will tell next year in Europe, I think, as to how much Celtic miss him or whether Johnston can step up and fill in for him and excel as well. But in terms of this move, I mean, I think the size of club might be quite mystifying for many people, but he is joining a club who are third in the Bundesliga. Only Bayern have more points than them. So he could well be playing Champions League football next season. And I mean, they're still in the Europa League this season too. So I can see his reasons for choosing Union Berlin, but I also feel there's a part there where a number of big clubs and top clubs in these leagues were showing interest. I mean, we knew about Atletico Madrid, Barcelona, Chelsea, Man United, and then further down the Premier League, there was the likes of Villa, Southampton, but none of them made an offer. So it got to the stage where Celtic were keen to have a resolution to this, and there was a club here offering up to £10 million. A deal worth £10 million is what they agreed on, and I think in the end might not have been his first choice of place to move. It might not have been a choice at all he was thinking about at the start of the transfer window, but he is joining a club who are on the up in the Bundesliga, and so you can see his reasons for it. And for Celtic, I think it's decent business. They probably feel they probably wanted more money in general, but at this stage of the window, when there's no other bids coming in from them, I think they've done well to get the 10 million.
And in the other direction, they're still after the South Korean striker Hyun Yu. Oh, what do you know about him?
Yeah, well, we've been reporting this quite. I've been reporting this for quite a while, that Celtic have sent scouts all over the world this last couple of years, and in particular, looking in Asia, the Middle East, North Africa. I mean, they've identified a number of targets from those regions. Celtic were initially trying to sign O's South Korean teammate Ju Sung Oh, who people will remember from the World Cup, him scoring those two goals against Ghana. I mean, they'd made a £3 million bid to John Book Hyundai Motors. This was Celtic's number one target a couple of weeks ago for a striker. But Joe seems to be weighing up his options. He's also had interest in bids from Mainz and Minnesota. But actually looks like he might even stay in this window, because he feels like he's not up to full fitness with the Korean League being off and him, his last game being at the World Cup. So Celtic have moved on to their next target, and this is I mean, they've now agreed a deal with Suwon Blue Wings. I believe that's a £2.5 million deal. He's verbally, at the time of us recording, he's verbally agreed personal terms, and it should be finalised this week. So he may well be confirmed by the time many people are listening to this, but in terms of what do I know about him personally, as a player, I don't know too much about him. I'd be lying if I said I knew much about the K League. But he's certainly, from what I've been told, he's a tall striker, a big striker, but he's also quite dynamic. He could potentially fill that void that Giakoumakis, if Georgios Giakoumakis leaves as well. So I think Celtic just getting in like for like. If players are going, they do seem to be prepared to have plans to replace them.
On the other side of the city, Andrew, Rangers, there's finally some movement. Tell me a wee bit about Todd Cantwell. What is he going to bring to the side?
Well, depending on what version of Todd Cantwell turns up at Ibrox, it could be a really exciting signing for Rangers. He is a player who, nearly 18 months ago, so going back to the summer window of 2021, at that point there was talk about him potentially being a £40 to £50 million signing for Aston Villa. Now, that clearly has not materialised in his career. It looks as though he's very much gone the other way. Norwich have gone down into the Championship. He's not always played for them this season. He seems to have lost his way quite a bit. But if you look at clips of some of his kind of better bits, if you like, he's clearly a very, very capable player, direct, fairly distinctive sort of style of dribbling. Someone who clearly, if he plays the way he can play, will be a big, big hit in Scottish football, but it's just whether he is or not. The one thing I would say is that Michael Beale, this is the kind of challenge for me Michael Beale will absolutely be embracing. You know, he is a coach, first and foremost, Michael Beale. He's evolved into a manager, but, you know, getting a young player, and he is still pretty young, what, 24, I think he is, you know, at that age, with decent experience in the Premier League and Championship for Norwich over a number of years and kind of recently with Bournemouth as well. If he is someone that's lost his way a little bit, I would imagine Michael Beale will be really excited about trying to steer him back in the right direction. Now, Rangers, you know, I mean, Ryan Kent has been, I think, head and shoulders above everybody else in terms of being Rangers' best player since Beale came in. I would imagine, although Cantwell plays a different position, he is somebody who is creative too and can probably take the pressure off Kent a little bit. He, as I say, if he is the kind of player that we saw 2 or 3 years ago playing for Norwich City, it's a fantastic acquisition for Rangers. Rangers actually have been a little bit vague on the details. It's a long-term deal, so we don't know exactly how long that is. And there's not much mention of the finances either. But given the amount of money that was being discussed as a potential fee, and you were looking at him going into Villa and being a replacement for Jack Grealish, that's the kind of standard of player we're talking about here. If Rangers have been able to pick him up, even if it's a nominal fee that they've had to pay, this has all the potential to be a really good piece of business from Rangers.
How do managers that are under pressure right now approach this time of year? Because, I mean, are they shopping with one eye on who could potentially save their job?
They are. And this is, it's such an interesting time because we always talk about, why does business get done so late? I mean, they've got a whole month to do it, or in the summer, they've got months to do it. And yet still, a lot of business comes down to deadline day or the few days before it. And it is a case of people panic. And as much as club managers and chairmen and sporting directors say, oh, they've got this plan, they've got things all planned out, things don't go to plan. And then you have a couple of bad results and then you panic. You feel you need to get someone in and you need to galvanize your team. You need someone to lift your squad, and you see a player that's available and think, well, this guy could probably do it. Or it's just such a, I find it so fascinating, the transfer windows and the kind of psychology to it. Especially when it comes down to the last couple of weeks and further towards deadline day. And there's, like we're just saying there, there's so many managers in the Scottish Premiership who are under pressure. That's why I think it's going to be There's going to be a lot of board meetings. There's going to be a lot of recruitment meetings. There's going to be a lot of kind of feelers put out to intermediaries and agents and players and to see who's interested to come to certain clubs, who's available as well. For this window in the Scottish Premiership, a lot of managers are looking for that player who's going to get them to the top six, get them into Europe, avoid relegation. So it is saving their jobs.
A bad night last night, you're having a f***ing horrendous one now.
So we've heard from the journalists and we're up to date on the news, but what about the agents? It's a door that's very rarely opened in football, but we wanted to find out what they actually do, and specifically at this time of year. I caught up with Adrian Brennan, football agent for Quorum Sports. Adrian, thanks for joining us. Can you give us a bit of context into who you are, who you work for, what it is you actually do?
So I work as an agent here in Scotland for a company called Quorum Sports. So we have our head office in London, and we represent around 50, 60 players from basically from the English, Scottish, Irish leagues, and also more recently some of the European and international markets. So we have players in the US, Sweden, Belgium, Italy. And yeah, it's quite an exciting time for the agency because we're growing quite a lot. So in terms of my job itself, I head up the Scottish operations for the company. So I'm a registered football intermediary with the English FA. And my job is essentially looking after the 13 or 14 players that I've got signed to my name here in Scotland, using my network of contacts and my experience to do the players' deals and maintain the relationships that we've got with them and try and build on that portfolio of clients, really. So in a nutshell, I suppose that's, what the job encompasses.
What is this time of year like for you? It must be busier than normal.
Yeah, it's definitely a busy time in terms of the January window being open here in Scotland and England and most of the European markets. Obviously, as a lot of people are aware, the markets are different, the windows are different from country to country. But yeah, the vast majority of windows are open now in January. But what I would say is the winter window is quite different to the summer one. It's obviously much shorter, so far fewer deals are done to begin with. And then it also comes at a kind of awkward time in the year. The majority of players are still under contract. So what you tend to find is there's quite a large number of loan deals that are done, and maybe players from, what we'd consider to be the summer leagues, some of the Scandinavian leagues, North American leagues, etc. So a lot of players coming from those leagues where maybe they've finished their contract in November time or December or whatever. The other dynamic that you have in January is a lot of the clubs don't really have 100% clarity on their budgets. Obviously, they're halfway through the season, so they don't know exactly how much they're going to be spending. Sometimes they don't know which league they're going to be in. So from that point of view, I've certainly found from my experience far fewer, long-term deals are handed out in January time. From an agency point of view, I suppose there's different sorts of deals that are done in January. You've got pre-contracts that happen. You've got lots of loan deals, as I mentioned. And then sometimes, players who sign on a permanent deal and are then loaned back for the rest of the season to their original club. So there's all of that aspect. But yeah, I always tell people it's a different window in January, different dynamics, different variables. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not so good. But yeah, it's certainly very busy at this time of year.
So have you ever been involved in any last minute dramatic deals?
Yeah, I don't know about dramatic. I don't know about you. I feel the whole transfer deadline day scenario, with the likes of Jim White and the yellow tie and the yellow ticker at the bottom and the timeline and everything counting down. I feel it's all a bit theatrical. And obviously, don't get me wrong, those deals do happen. There are scenarios where, there are these kind of deals taking place in the top leagues. But for every one of those, I think there's hundreds of other deals that take place, behind the scenes for more modest figures, far less rushed and far, more less exciting, I suppose, deals. For every dramatic Aaron Ramsey to Rangers or Robbie Keane to Celtic. I suppose there's hundreds of other ones that, you know, that take place and people don't really, really know much about. So, you know, I can't say I've been involved in many dramatic last minute deals. What I have encountered, I suppose, is deals maybe not happening that you thought might happen at the last minute, which can be frustrating, or, you know, potentially deals happening really quickly at some stage. So you need to be on your toes. You need to be ready, plan for all eventualities and make sure the player's ready in case he does need to move.
See, I don't think a lot of fans will be aware of the actual intricacies of a deal. Can you explain what the process is from start to finish?
It's a fair point. I didn't know much about it before I started working in the industry about 10 or 12 years ago. But I'd say, first of all, there's a hell of a lot goes on behind the scenes and, you know, over quite a substantial period of time, and people don't necessarily always realise that. So it's not just a case of a deal being done over a few days and then, you know, taking a nice photograph for the club's Twitter page, things like that. You know, it's a much longer term process. For instance, all the clubs have their target lists, the players that they're looking at. So if they're looking for a left-sided centre-back, they might have 5 names, they might have 10 names on that list. And that's an evolving list. It's not static. It's not one point in time where it's always the same. It's constantly moving. So they'll narrow down those lists. They'll be working on it for months in advance. The communication tends to be initially from the chief scout or head of recruitment, who'll come to me, who'll come to the agent, and basically try and sound out whether there's an appetite for a deal from the player, whether financially it might work. And then from the agent's point of view, I'll be doing similar. You know, I'll be drawing up a list of potential options for my client. I'll be discussing it with him, whether that's a contract renegotiation at his current club or a deal to a new club. I'll be using my databases, I'll be using my spreadsheets and, you know, working out what's the best deal. And it's not always financially. Sometimes it's, you know, what's the pathway to the first team? Where's he going to play more regularly? Do they give youth a chance? Do they play younger players? So all of this process is ongoing. A lot of phone calls, emails, WhatsApp is used a lot these days, like in a lot of jobs, meetings, phone calls, all the rest of it. You then have different people that get involved at different stages. So the chief scout would typically hand over to the head of to the chief exec or the sports director, who comes in and negotiates. That's when the nitty-gritty of the deal actually takes place, and you have to stand strong and negotiate well. And there's an understanding that at some stage there might be a compromise. So if you're going to a club and you're asking for X, Y, and Z, they might be asking for something quite different. Generally, you try and find a point of, you know, compromise somewhere in the middle. And towards the end of the process, I guess it's the signing day where you turn up with the player. I always like to be there, check over the paperwork, make sure everything reads exactly as was agreed. You then have the medical. Sometimes I'll send the player away to do the medical whilst I check through the paperwork, because it tends to be quite a boring process for some of the young players. They'll come back, they'll do the photographs, and depending on the level of the deal, there might be in-house media who'll do some pieces with them, or, you know, local press, national press. And that's more or less the process, sort of, in summary.
See, the impression I get a lot of the time is players don't really get involved in the deals much. They just want to be told what's happening. Yeah. Is this something you found? Is there actually any players that have taken active interest in your work?
Yeah, it does vary, as you say. I mean, you'll get some players who naturally are quite academic or quite good with numbers. They might come from a family where, you know, a parent has been a football player who's maybe experienced it themselves, so they have a natural sort of interest and desire to look at the figures. But certainly the majority are quite happy. They've signed up with you. They know that, just like signing up with a lawyer or someone else that provides professional advice, you're there to do a job, and you've been doing it for years. You know, I've been doing it for 10, 11 years, like I say. So it's a case of using that experience, and you end up coming across similar clauses and similar things in the contract that, you know, prepare you well for the next deal. So I'd say the majority of players entrust you in the process, you know.
Is it quite common for agents to, like, plant seeds or leak stories to journalists and stuff, and if so, is that to benefit the players?
Yeah, it does happen, I suppose. Yeah, journalists rely on agents. Many good agents rely on journalists as well. So I suppose it's a mutually beneficial relationship at times. You know, if you look at the newspapers, particularly right now during the transfer window, you'll find a large percentage of the content it's transfer speculation. That's just the way it works. And often this does come from conversations between agents and journalists. So I'd say yes, it definitely happens. It happens in every market, in every country around the world. From an agent's point of view, it can help build a story, build a narrative. It can help from a negotiation point of view, you know. So yeah, ultimately the final goal, I suppose, the objective is to try and benefit the player in terms of obtaining the best contract you can. So yeah, I'd say that definitely does happen from time to time.
What about outside of the transfer window then? Do you guys get involved in anything like player care, media training, like career advice or anything like that with the boys?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's, again, something that's perhaps a bit of a misconception, that there's not really all that much more to it. I could rhyme off a lot of things that are involved in football agency apart from the contract negotiation part of it. You know, I've had players who've come to me asking for advice on doing their coaching badges, using your contacts to help set them up. Or it could be learning a trade, you know, being, maybe they want to become an engineer or a painter and decorator, and, you know, they're thinking towards the end of their career. So that does happen. And I'm always one that highlights the educational side of things. I suppose I'm quite biased. I, you know, loved my education. My other big passion apart from football is languages. And, you know, I studied, my undergrad degree was business and languages. So that's kind of how I got into the football agency side of things. So I'm always, there's quite a few players actually spring to mind. I've been really trying to highlight the importance of things like, you know, having another hobby, especially if you've got a lot of time off, if you're off injured or whatever. I think the number of people that I've tried to convince to use the Duolingo language app in recent years is quite incredible. I should be on commission from them, the number of people I've got. But yeah, developing other interests in different areas, that's massive. And I think, you know, if you consider how many years the typical football player's career lasts, what is it, 10, 15 years, if you're retiring at the age of 30 to 35, actually, in a strange way, the majority of your life, you're not a footballer, you are something else. So you have another career. My kind of rule of thumb is that if you've not played for Celtic or Rangers or in the English Championship and above, with a few exceptions, you more or less are going to have to work in some capacity afterwards. That's the reality based on the salaries we have here. So always highlighting, you know, alternative careers and the importance of education is something that I try and do, you know, as much as possible.
Well, that's all from us this week. A huge thank you to Andrew and Anthony for joining me in the show, and of course to all of you out there for listening. We're all busy with deadline day shifts and matches and, well, babies next week, so we've got something a wee bit different for you. Join us next Tuesday for a special episode on pitches and how they survive, or why they don't survive, the winter weather. I caught up with Motherwell's head groundsman Paul Matthew for a really insightful chat, so join us for that one. And as for the full show, we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. It's also the return of someone very special indeed. You won't want to miss it. Bye.